Lecture 5, Athletes of God.
Welcome back. In the last lecture, we examined the struggle between Christianity and paganism during the 4th century, and we examined in detail the reign of Julian the Apostate, the last pagan emperor, who, during his short reign from 361 to 363, attempted unsuccessfully to revive paganism within the Roman Empire. Today, we're going to examine one of the most important consequences of the conversion of Constantine to Christianity, namely the emergence of a new emphasis on asceticism within Christianity and the emergence of holy men who embodied the ascetic ideal. We're also going to examine how Christian theologians during the 4th and the 5th centuries developed increasingly sophisticated and, to contemporaries, persuasive arguments on behalf of the notion that celibacy and virginity were the ideal states for human beings. During the pre-Constantinian period, when Christianity was an illegal religion and a persecuted one at times, Christianity's religious elite consisted of confessors and of martyrs. Confessors were individuals who openly professed their Christianity to Roman officials in the expectation that they would be martyred for making this open statement of their beliefs. Martyrs were those who were actually killed after confessing their Christianity. Christians looking for the ultimate spiritual challenge, wanted to test their mettle, became confessors to see if they could withstand the fear that accompanied announcing one's Christianity and courting death in this manner. To accept martyrdom was to imitate Jesus of Nazareth as perfectly as a human being could. It was to submit oneself to Roman authorities, just as Jesus of Nazareth had done. It was to accept one's own death willingly, just as Jesus of Nazareth had done, in order to atone for the sins of humanity. Indeed, the act of confessing one's belief in the expectation of martyrdom was seen as so spiritually meritorious that it was regarded as a second baptism. It wiped clean all the sins that one had committed up to that point in time. Martyrdom, as you might imagine, required a great deal of fortitude. But it also required, more surprisingly, a great deal of persistence, because we have in our possession a number of trial transcripts, actual records that are jotted down as martyrs are examined by Roman officials. And these transcripts often reveal how hard it was to get oneself martyred. Because while Romans had no trouble killing people for not paying their taxes, the notion of killing people for a religious belief was rather alien to the pagan way of thinking. Martyrs often had to undergo two or three successive trials before they could actually be executed. At the end of the first trial, when found guilty, the Roman judge would throw you back into the prison and say, "You should think about this for a while because you're actually going to be dead if you go through with this." And so you had to appear before the judge one more time as the Romans virtually begged you not to go through with this. Roman prosecutors would cajole Christians, often in quite moving terms, asking them to look outside and look at the beautiful day, and what a shame it would be that you're not going to see any more days like this one. Do you really want to die for a religious belief? And prosecutors, local Roman judges, often tried to find some sort of compromise with individual Christians and with Christian communities so that they didn't actually have to kill people. Among the compromises that would be offered to a Christian community in a time of persecution, well, Christians would be asked, "If you don't want to offer a sacrifice to the pagan gods, how about one just to the emperor? And we'll just call him an emperor rather than emperor and god. And would that be acceptable to you?" Some Christians welcomed the opportunity to get off the hook, but others refused this particular offer. Sometimes the nature of the sacrifice would be open to debate. If you won't kill an animal, perhaps a pinch of incense, maybe a really small pinch of incense, would that be acceptable to you? The hardiest of the Christians would not even accept that. One very resourceful North African governor, when charged with destroying all copies of the Christian gospel, notified local Christian authorities that he had to burn all copies of the gospel and that this would be a difficult task because he didn't know what the gospel actually looked like or said. So if the Christians handed over to him any book at all, whose contents he did not recognize, and said that it was a gospel well, he would just have to take their word for it, wouldn't he? And then we could all go home at the end of the day. Harried Roman officials often looked for a way to clear their outbox of Christian martyrs. But some Christians indeed persisted to the end and refused every effort at accommodation on the part of Romans. The conversion of Constantine changed the situation dramatically. It had been somewhat hard to get yourself martyred before, but now that Christianity was becoming the official religion of the Roman Empire, it was impossible to get oneself martyred within the confines of the Roman Empire, and there was no certainty of martyrdom if one traveled beyond the confines of that empire. Furthermore, the conversion of Constantine resulted in an influx of many opportunistic converts to Christianity as people saw the writing on the wall and became Christian because of job advancement, to make their own lives easier. These new Christian converts seemed to the old Christians, to those who had weathered the persecution of Diocletian, for example, to be rather namby-pamby in their faith, and Christianity seemed to be more watered down. It was becoming harder and harder to stand out from the crowd, and the crowd was increasingly one from which you wanted to stand out because its own faith was so lukewarm. And this confluence of trends was going to lead more and more individuals to follow the example of a man named Antony, an Egyptian who was remarkably long-lived, born around 250, did not die until around 355, and he made it well into his 90s. Antony began to pioneer in the deserts of Egypt a new type of Christian heroism that was going to resonate powerfully with those who were seeking a spiritual challenge in the post-Constantinian world. Antony was orphaned at a relatively young age. He lost both of his parents in his late teens, and shortly after the death of both of his parents, as he's going through a period of searching in his life, he heard the gospel text, a text that was going to change more than one life in the history of the Middle Ages. Gospel passage in which Jesus of Nazareth stated that all those who wish to be perfect should sell all that they possess and should give it to the poor and come and follow him. It's the same passage that would inspire Francis of Assisi almost 1,000 years later. Antony decided that he was going to follow this command quite literally. He sells everything he possesses and decides that to follow Jesus, he's going to retreat into the deserts of Egypt and abandon civilization. He lives there for a while and decides that this lifestyle in the desert is not sufficiently tough. Revealingly, he attempts to get himself martyred by traveling to Alexandria at one point, cannot get himself martyred by local Roman officials, and so resigns himself to the notion that he's going to have to carve out a new sort of life for himself in the deserts of Egypt. Antony attracted followers, which was the last thing that he wanted to do, because he wished to live as a hermit. But Egyptians who heard about Antony and his life in the desert came to admire him, and they travel out in the desert to live near him. Whenever they approached, he would move farther out into the desert and try and lose them, but they were persistent, and eventually he reconciled himself to the notion that there were going to be others living nearby. As for the type of life that Antony was leading in Egypt, in the deserts of Egypt, that was inspiring people to come and follow him, it was a life of rigorous asceticism that consisted of long and punishing fasts in which he would not eat for days on end, in which he tries to reduce his consumption of food to the bare minimum necessary for human survival. It is a life characterized by long vigils at night in the cold of the desert and depriving himself of sleep as much as possible. And it is a life of sexual abstinence, total sexual abstinence. His self-deprivation, his mortification of his own flesh, gives him spiritual powers beyond those of ordinary Christians. He is able to confront Satan directly in the desert and triumph in these one-on-one encounters. And his contemporaries in Egypt refer to Antony and to his followers as a monachos. The lonely one is literal translation. We get the word monk from this term. Although Antony came to personify the ascetic ideal, the life in which you do not eat more than you have to, you do not sleep very often, in which you abstain from all sexual activity. And although contemporaries called him Monachos, he's not exactly the founding father of monasticism, because he always wanted to be a hermit, and he always wanted to live apart from other human beings. Some of those who followed Antony, however, and admired him, did develop a more monastic lifestyle, in which those who lived an ascetic life lived in a community and encouraged one another. And the individual who is responsible for gathering followers of Antony into a community is an Egyptian by the name of Pachomius, who dies in 346. Pachomius and those who lived with Pachomius engaged in collective activities together. They would gather several times a day to pray and then retreat to individual caves for their own devotions. And Pachomius becomes the leader of these individuals. He maintains discipline among them, and the followers accept his judgments. Pachomius himself regarded the collective lifestyle in which ascetics would gather for prayer several times a day and then retreat to their own caves as merely a preparatory stage. It was a training ground or boot camp for the ultimate challenge, which was to follow Antony into the desert and which was to live by yourself. But some of Pachomius's followers regarded the collective life in the desert as sufficiently challenging as an end in and of itself rather than as a means to an end. And so communal living became relatively commonplace among the ascetics of Egypt during the 4th century. During the course of that century, the individual elements of what we would later regard as monasticism fall into place. You see, for example, the building of individual houses for all of the monks to live in together rather than simply gathering from various parts at certain times of the day. You see the term abbot, Abba, father, applied to the head of the monastery as the abbot assumes responsibility for supervising the various monks. And you see, perhaps most importantly, the emergence of written rules, guidelines by which the monks are expected to abide. A bishop in the eastern half of the Roman Empire named Basil of Caesarea, who dies in 379, composes probably the first written rule for monks, and living according to a written rule or a regula becomes one of the defining characteristics of the medieval monk. In fact, monks are sometimes referred to as the regular clergy because they live according to a regula or a rule, and this differentiates them from the secular clergy, the priests and the bishops, those who live in the world and do not have to live according to a specific written rule. Monasticism is only one of the religious movements to emerge in Egypt or in Syria during the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries. The conversion of Constantine and the fact that martyrdom is not readily available anymore resulted in a remarkable period of religious experimentation as people tried to find new forms of Christian heroicism. And although monasticism would eventually become the most widespread and the most popular, we should not forget some of the other experiments that are conducted in this part of the world at this time. For example, there's the grazer movement. Grazers were holy men who lived by eating only grass and shoots, and sometimes went so far as to chain themselves up like barnyard animals, and in a sense attempted to rid themselves of their own humanity. There was the Holy Fool movement, which was popular in the 5th and 6th centuries, especially in Syria. And Holy Fools were late antique ascetics who defied social conventions and who behaved absurdly on purpose, in a sense to shock contemporaries. Probably the most famous of these was Simeon the Fool, who lived in the 6th century, and who would do things that no one would expect of an individual. For example, one time he paraded into the women's bathhouse and disrobed and jumped into the bath, at which point he was beaten by the women and thrown out, who suspected that he was not as foolish as he appeared to be. But the purpose of the Holy Fool movement, in a sense, was to rid yourself of reason and to rely on God almost exclusively to guide one's behavior. Most famously, there's the Stylite movement. However, Stylites were individuals who lived atop tall poles and stylites were especially popular in 5th and 6th century Syria. The founder of the stylite movement is Simeon the Stylite, who dies in 459, and who is said to have lived atop a 50-foot pole for 40 years. His followers would bring him food via a ladder, and he would bring the food up to himself, eat it, and then lower the ladder periodically. And as if living on top of a pillar, exposed to the elements year-round, was not sufficiently harsh, he would perform painful physical exercises while atop the pole. His biographer claims that he at one point touched his feet with his head 1,244 times in succession. He had many admirers. People would come to gather and look at Simeon the Stylite on top of this pole. And according to one contemporary biographer, the crowds gathered, I quote, to worship the worms as they dropped from his body. The Stylite movement, the Grazer movement, the Holy Fool movement remained fringe movements for the most part. Few were able to bring themselves to imitate these rather exotic forms of religious life, for they never caught on outside of Syria and Egypt in the way that monasticism was going to catch on. Monasticism spreads to the western half of the Roman Empire fairly quickly. Already during the 4th century, you start to see the emergence of mass monastic communities in the West. And the main force that drives the spread of monasticism is a book. A book written by a bishop by the name of Athanasius. Athanasius was bishop of Alexandria in Egypt, so he's familiar with Antony. And he writes a book called The Life of St. Antony, which quickly becomes very popular throughout the whole of the Roman Empire and informs people about what was going on in Egypt. Athanasius invented with this book a wholly new literary genre, the hagiography, Lives of the Saints, which supplants the Passions of the Martyrs as the most popular form of Christian literature. Individuals enjoyed, loved reading about the saints and the types of lives that they were leading. By the end of the 4th century, monastic communities were not all that rare in Western Europe, and you also start to see the writing down of monastic rules in the West, the earliest of which is composed around 420 by an individual named John Cassian, who had spent some time in Egypt living there as a monk and brought back some of his experiences there to the West and put them into his monastic rule. During the 5th and 6th centuries, monasticism made more headway in the West. The most important monastic rule for the Middle Ages is composed in the first half of the 6th century by St. Benedict of Nursia. And a sign of the increasing prestige of monasticism in the West is the election of the first monk as a pope. Pope Gregory the First, or Gregory the Great, who is pope from 590 to 604, and who maintained a monastic lifestyle even after his election as pope and helped to popularize monasticism in that way. Although monasticism travels from east to west, it changed in the process of that journey. And Western monasticism in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries was in some ways rather different from the monasticism of Pachomius in the deserts of Egypt. Western monasteries tended to be rather small establishments. You might have a dozen or two monks living in one as opposed to the hundreds that you might find in a large Egyptian monastery. These Western monasteries were often located in towns, oddly enough, rather than in the woods, for example. And this was rather contrary to the spirit of Egyptian monasticism, where the goal was to get away from people as much as possible. And many of the Western monasteries were frankly rather wimpy when compared to an Egyptian monastery, in that the individuals living in these monasteries were not wholly committed to the ascetic ideal. What often happened was that an elderly individual, usually a man, but perhaps a wife, who had lost a spouse, decided to convert your house into a monastery towards the end of your life. And you would gather together some elderly friends who were in a similar situation, and you would join together and live according to a rule, often one of your own devising. And since it was often of your own devising, it was often not terribly, terribly strict. In a sense, Western monasteries in the 4th and 5th, 6th centuries functioned almost as retirement communities where elderly individuals could gather together and practice religious devotion, but also enjoy one another's companionship. You could also find in these monasteries not only many elderly people, but a lot of young people as well, because the practice of giving young children whom you could not support to monasteries catches on in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries. These young children are known as oblates. And when you give a child to a monastery and entrust it to the monks to take care of the child, theoretically the child is supposed to remain in the monastery for the rest of his or her life. Upon attaining the age of reason, you might be invited to leave if you would so choose, but it would take a tremendous amount of courage if all you had known was a monastery to go out and try and live on your own. And because these oblates had often found themselves placed in a monastery without being asked about it, their sense of vocation was not always that strong. And so they too did not practice asceticism in the way that, say, an Antony would have approved of. Lay people were willing to support these monasteries in part because they served important societal functions. They are places that will take care of the very young and the very old. But also because even if they are not as rigorously ascetic as one might like, nonetheless, the holy lifestyle of the monks within gives them a special relationship to God, a better relationship than the one that you enjoy. And therefore, the prayers of the monks are going to be more efficacious than your own prayers. And so you're willing to endow monasteries with gifts of money or land in the hope that the monks will then pray on your behalf. Christian emphasis on asceticism and the notion that celibacy is the best state for human beings to be in is not wholly without classical and pagan precedent. Nonetheless, asceticism and celibacy and virginity certainly have a place within Christianity, Christian religious thought and practice, that far exceeded anything that existed in classical antiquity. You can't find the occasional pagan philosopher who would argue that the best state for human beings is virginity. But for the most part, pagan philosophers were suspicious of sexual abstinence just as much as they were suspicious of sexual excess. Both of these were regarded in Roman medical thought, for example, to be bad for you. Sexual excess was especially bad for men because it would cause you to lose your vital heat and become more womanly. But sexual abstinence would cause you to become lazy, and it would also give you headaches. For Roman philosophers, for your average Roman in the street, sexual abstinence seemed rather threatening. It seemed threatening to the whole Roman social order and to the very existence of civilization, because everything around you, the towns and the cities, everything that people had constructed, would remain in existence only if the human race also remained in existence to continue the empire. The only way, as a Roman pagan, that you could cheat death, given uncertainty about the existence of an afterlife, which some pagans will accept and some pagans will reject, the only way for you to cheat death is to produce children who will carry on after you are gone, and who make it seem as if those who had died long ago are still walking the earth because they resemble you and they look like you. There are virgin priestesses within Roman pagan religion. The Vestal Virgins of Rome are probably the most famous example. But Vestal Virgins were only supposed to remain virgin until the age of 30, at which point they would do what most Roman women should do. They're supposed to get married and have kids at that point. And no pagan regarded the Vestal Virgins as representing humanity at its very peak, as achieving the best that human beings could achieve. Since the first decades of Christianity's existence, a lively debate had taken place among Christian thinkers about the place of celibacy and marriage and intercourse within the Christian religion. If you read the letters of St. Paul, especially to the Corinthians, you will see how some of these debates played out. The spread of asceticism from Egypt to the West in the 4th century, though, gives new urgency to the arguments about celibacy and marriage because more and more people are starting to embrace the ascetic ideal. And you can find some 4th century Christian authors, one thinks of Jovinian, for example, who maintained that the celibate found no special favor with God. that all baptized Christians are spiritually equal. There is no need for anyone to strive to remain in a state of perpetual virginity. Why would God approve of that? But against Jovinian and those who thought like him, formidable Christian theologians, people such as Bishop Ambrose of Milan or Jerome and St. Augustine himself, developed sophisticated arguments in defense of sexual abstinence and asceticism more generally. Ambrose of Milan argued that Christians must have chaste individuals as their leaders, that it would be necessary eventually for priests and certainly bishops to be chaste, and ideally they should not be married at all. Ambrose argued that married and unchaste husbands and wives are spiritually inferior to virgins, and that married couples should always guard against excessive pleasure in intercourse. Jerome shocked contemporaries, including a large number of Christian contemporaries, when he suggested that first marriages were acceptable if regrettable capitulations to human needs, but second marriages are only slightly better than traveling to your local brothel. Now, as for why virginity and chastity are spiritually meritorious, well, Ambrose and Jerome and Augustine could agree on the notion that asceticism made human beings more like angels. Angels are incorporeal beings. They do not experience the bodily drives, the need to eat, the urge to procreate that human beings do, and they are far closer to God than any human being is. If you are able to tame or subdue or even eliminate these drives from yourself, then you in your own life can approximate an angel and draw yourself closer to God. Another argument in favor of the ascetic ideal centered on Adam and Eve. Adam had not been battered by what we would call primal drives. He didn't need to eat. He didn't need to procreate. And he had led a life of uncorrupted tranquility. If human beings wanted to get back and experience life as Adam had experienced it in paradise, then they too needed to rid themselves of these drives that had been introduced after original sin. Of all the early Christian church fathers, however, none would be more influential on this topic, as on so many others, than St. Augustine, the bishop of Hippo in North Africa, who died in 430. Augustine was somewhat more moderate than Jerome on this issue, as on many others, although we often regard Augustine as being a very stern individual, which he was in a sense. Seen in his context, he often takes the middle road and is reacting against extremes to either side. Augustine chastened celibates that they should not look down upon the married, they should not scorn the state of marriage, and he debated Jerome and Ambrose concerning the seemingly odd issue of whether intercourse and marriage had existed in paradise. Jerome and Ambrose had shared the assumption that intercourse was unknown in paradise, and perhaps marriage itself too had not existed then. That like death, like physical pain, they had come into the world as a result of original sin. Augustine felt that that was going too far, that intercourse and marriage had existed in paradise, and that therefore they were part of God's original plan for all of humanity. They are not wholly the product of original sin. And in that sense, Augustine destigmatized marriage and intercourse, but only to a certain extent, because Augustine still maintained that celibacy was superior to married life. And the reason for that, according to Augustine, is that while original sin had not given rise to marriage and intercourse, it had transformed them and made them something wholly different from what had existed before the fall. According to Augustine, Adam had had a control over himself that no human being could have after the fall, which is to say that his conscious will and desire coincided perfectly. To put it as delicately as I can, when Adam wanted to perform, he did. And if he didn't want to, he didn't. And he was sort of able to will himself into a state of readiness or not will himself. No human being could do this anymore. Everyone, every male at least, experienced a constant rebellion of your own body against yourself that reflected in microcosm Adam and Eve's rebellion against God's will. Because you cannot control yourself anymore, because your own body sort of reflects the impact of original sin, well, celibacy is superior to the married life. In conclusion, the conversion of Constantine at the end of imperial persecution necessitated a change in Christian heroism. With martyrdom no longer readily available, dedicated Christians, eager to excel in their faith, began to imitate the example of Antony, abandoning the world and living lives of great austerity and self-deprivation based on the avoidance of food and drink, sleep, of marriage and sexual intercourse. During the 4th and 5th centuries, some individuals who pursued the ascetic ideal began to gather together into communities of monks living under the supervision of an abbot. And at the same time, church fathers such as Ambrose and Jerome and Augustine developed arguments concerning the superiority of celibacy to marriage, arguments that would resonate well past the end of the Middle Ages. But we've barely scratched the surface of the profundity and originality of Augustinian thought. So in the next two lectures, we're going to examine the life and the writings of the remarkable Bishop of Hippo.